Welcome, everybody. My name is Margot Smith. I'm the director of Kluge Rue Aboriginal Art Collection. And I'd like to welcome you to First People, Indigenous Writers from Australia and North America. And the first thing I'd like to do as we get started tonight is take just a moment to recognize the traditional owners of the land that we're on today, the Monacan people, and pay my respects, and I invite you to do as well, to their elders and the generations of Monacan people who have owned this land and continue to own this land. Thank you. Well, there's a lot of people to thank for this program tonight. Our co-sponsors, Australia Council for the Arts, the Embassy of Australia, Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, the Mary and David Harrison Institute for American History, Literature, and Culture, and specifically Lucy Wall Stylianopoulos, who has been so gracious to allow us to use this space and to plan this event with us. She's the director of Intellectual Crossroads and the Harrison Institute, and her staff, and also the Office of the Provost and Vice Provost for the Arts. Also, I'd like to recognize Lauren Maupin, who's in the back. She's the Education and Programs Coordinator at Kluge Rue, and she had a hand in planning every aspect and implementing every aspect of this event, even down to the lovely design of the program. So I really appreciate her efforts. The seed for this event was planted a year ago during a visit by Kathy Craigie, CEO and founder of First Nations Australia Writers Network, while she was in the USA investigating the possibility of presenting Indigenous Australian writers at the National Book Festival. And I'd like to give a little biography of Kathy. I'm going to invite her up to the podium in just a minute. Kathy Craigie is a Gamilaroi and Anyawan woman from northern New South Wales. She's worked in Aboriginal affairs for over 30 years. She was one of the original founders of Koori Radio, Gadigal Information Service, and has worked in senior positions within the Australia Council and the New South Wales Department of Aboriginal Affairs. She's held a variety of key positions in other Aboriginal arts, health, and housing organizations at national and international levels. And she's also an aspiring writer and has written several plays and stories. She was festival curator of Gwanyi, which translates as to tell, the National Aboriginal Writers Festival held at New South Wales Writing Centre. And I'll call up Kathy in just a moment after I'm done with these preliminary introductions. In developing this program, we also wanted to include Native American writers and asked Karen Wood, a member of the Monacan Indian Nation, the indigenous people from this area that I just acknowledged, and herself a published poet, to both participate in the panel and moderate it. So I'm also going to introduce Karen right now. Karen Wood is an enrolled member of the Monacan Indian Nation. She directs Virginia Indian programs at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. She holds an MFA in creative writing from George Mason University and is a PhD candidate and Ford Fellow in Linguistic Anthropology at the University of Virginia. She's worked at the National Museum of the American Indian as a researcher and at the Association on American Indian Affairs as a repatriation specialist. This year, she was honored as one of Virginia's women in history. Wood is the author of Markings on Earth, which won the North American Native Authors Award for Poetry in 2000, and of Weaving the Boundary, due out next spring. She edited the Virginia Indian Heritage Trail, and she contributed a chapter on Southeastern Indians to National Geographic's Indian Nations of North America. So I'm going to leave it to Kathy and to Karen to introduce the other writers who are going to present their work tonight. I think you will agree that we are exceptionally fortunate to have brought together such a talented and accomplished group of writers representing a variety of literary genres, from children's literature to fiction to poetry. And so please help me to introduce first Kathy Craigie, to welcome her.
Thank you, everybody, and I also want to acknowledge the traditional owners. Part of our own tradition in Australia is that we not only recognise the original inhabitants of the land, we also like to pay respects to elders in our audience because they're the carriers of wisdom and pass on. We came to the States, I mean, this year to follow up on a number of areas that we investigated last year when we came out, and this being one that we came up here to see the Klugeroo and have a talk, and we realised that we could do some, you know, Virginia, do some things around Charlottesville. But I think the other side that we came for the US Book Festival that's just happened last weekend in Washington, and that was quite incredible. We were the first country outside, apart from the US riders, to be invited to that festival, so we're quite honoured to be here. And then we're off to New York to do some readings and work there, and, you know, just to let you know that everybody's been so generous here with their time and allowing us to, you know, not only present but also to network, to talk to other people. And, you know, I think that's part of what we do. Even though we're writers, we're about messages, passing on messengers. We're messengers. We're passing on messages from our and information from our culture. So we're going. I think we're calling them up to here. I'm going to introduce our writers. Jared? Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. Sorry. So I'm going to introduce our writers to come up. The first one is Janine Liane. Janine is a Wiradjuri woman from southwest New South Wales. She has a PhD in literature and Aboriginal representation. She currently holds a postdoctoral fellowship at the Australian National University. And in 2010, Janine's first volume of poetry, Dark Secrets of Dreaming, won the Scanlon Prize for Indigenous Poetry. The rest of her bio is in the program, but Janine, would you like to come up and join? Ellen Van Nerven is a Yugambeh, sitting down there, is a Yugambeh woman from southeast Queensland, Australia. She's the author of the award-winning Heat and Light, this book is divided into three sections. It is inspired by the intersection of familial history, location and identity. And Ellen has been awarded a Queensland Writers Fellowship to pursue her next project in 2015. It's a novel about Aboriginal relationships with megafauna. Ellen? And Ellen's also our youngest writer that's here in the US. Jared Thomas is a Nukanu man of the Southern Flinders Ranges in South Australia and an author of young adult fiction. His debut novel, Sweet Guy, was shortlisted for three major Australian literature awards, and his children's novel, Dallas Davis, The Scientist and the City Kids, is published in the Oxford University Press Yarn and Strong series. Calypso Summer won the 2013 State Library of Queensland Black and White Fellowship and was included in iTunes Best Books of April 2014. Dub Leffler is a descendant from the Biggambul people of southeast Queensland who survived the 14-year Biggambul War of the 1840s in Australia. He's an accomplished author and illustrator with over 18 titles to his name and has collaborated with such luminaries as Colin Thompson, Sean Tan and Banksy. He's Australia's premier Indigenous illustrator of children's literature. And Dub's book, Once There Was a Boy, which he both wrote and illustrated, was one of the best-selling children's books of 2011 in Australia. And last but not least, Bruce Pascoe is of Bunurong, Yuin and Tasmanian heritage. His books include Shark, Ruby-Eyed, Kukulk, Ocean Earth and Nightjar. Bruce is one of our most prolific writers and he was published by Penguin for several years, but his Fogger Docks, which is a young adult novel, was published in 2012 by an Aboriginal publisher, Magabala, and it won the Prime Minister's Award for Young Adult Literature in 2013. And that's our writers. Give them a welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. Thanks to all of you for coming tonight. One of the things that we like to do as Native people is to welcome people to our homeland, as you understood earlier. And so I want to give a brief welcome to our guests and to all of you as a Native person. This is a prayer, and I'm invoking the Creator and the ancestors and asking them to bring us together with a good mind in this place and to leave our problems outside the door. You can pick them up on your way out if you'd like. but to just come together in a spirit of mutual harmony and understanding of the land. We live on the land that is global around us, and how important it is to sustain ourselves and our world in it. So yigun eukia sabahente wa yimnikas makshitambui tonsnena hambe nekewa aink wakasik henenu yesa mankiko ha yukan yota eoma bitoka henenhes kawaya konspeva nosai ika amai in yoma yaposki aim ika amai konspeva gedaya. I want to introduce Deborah Miranda, who is our other poet, and I'm so happy that she's able to join us here. And then I'm going to sit at the end and let our guests go first, because that's how we do things. Deborah Miranda is an Olon Costanoan Esalen woman of California. She was born in Los Angeles to an Esalen Chumash father and a mother of French ancestry. She grew up in Washington State, earning a B.S. teaching moderate special needs children from Wheelock College in 1983, and an M.A. and Ph.D. in English from the University of Washington. Miranda is a poet, and her collections of poetry include Indian Cartography Poems, The Zen of La Llorona, and recently she wrote her mixed genre collection, Bad Indians, a Tribal Memoir, I love that title, which won a gold medal from the Independent Publishers Association and was shortlisted for the William Saroyan Award. So we want to come up and sit here. And I think that we should start with Janine, and maybe we'll just kind of go down the line, and you'll get to hear from us in many different genres and many voices. Thank you.
Thank you. I also like to acknowledge the Monacan people on whose land we're gathered. Thank you. I'm going to, I did a poetry workshop this morning, and I'm really happy to see a lot of people here who were in my workshop. So I'll do one quick poem from the collection Dark Secrets and a short extract from my novel Purple Threads. This is a poem, and it's called History, They Write Us Wrong. Their swords are sharp, their guns are cruel, their pens are ruthless. With one fell swoop, they write us wrong. Pale hands move across blank pages, scratching words, journals, reports, letters, diaries, newspapers, rhapsodies in awe of whiteness on a grand scale, fertilized by black blood and bones. Distorted black images make the white lies of history strewn and scattered across pristine pages for future generations to read us by. We talked our men, brave, noble hunters, warriors, fathers, lovers, brothers, uncles, sons. But they write our men lazy, dirty, ignoble, thieves, slaves, drunks. We spoke our women, custodians, solid, proud, gatherers, mothers, daughters, sisters, aunties. They write our women primitive, promiscuous, ignorant, whores, servants. We talked our children, young, precious, hope, future. They write our children, vermin, troublesome, half-castes, outcasts. They write exterminate, assimilate, discriminate. They write that pens are mightier than swords. Their pens brand us so deep it stains us to the bone, filled with the ink that flows to pages like our blood to our land. White history always writes us wrong. Okay, and the second piece I'd like to read is from the title story of my novel called Purple Threads, and it, to me, it's probably the most important story because there's a little anecdote in here that got us through life, and I'll just fill you in the beginning of the story and I will read you from the end. It's about a day at school, and my sister and I went to school quite late because we managed to avoid that Western education for a while till we were about seven. Then when we were in school, it was very unwelcoming. And one day I thought some children were going to play with me, but they came up to me instead and said that I couldn't play with them because my aunties were black witches. And here is how the story the rest of the story goes, or the ending of the story, and how it actually made me feel at the time. And my auntie says, "How was school today, love? You getting to like it any better?" "I hate it. The kids say Auntie Boo and Auntie Bubby," my aunties, "are witches and they won't let me play with them." "Rotten little sods," Nan said. "She'd lost so many teeth her lips sagged and it made her lisp. You tell them if they don't leave you alone I'll walk in the way into town and clobber them with my broomstick. I'll give them witches all right." I sighed hopelessly. Although Nan had shown the most sympathy of all for my plight, I knew she wouldn't do it. She would never really go to town and hit some white kid with a broomstick as much as they deserved it. And even if she did, it would fuel the rumours even more. After tea, when Nan was tucked... Nan is my grandmother. When Nan was tucked up in bed, Auntie Boo and Auntie Bubby, Star, my sister, and I sat around the kitchen hearth. It was December and far too hot for a fire, but we always sat around the hearth, reading and telling stories and talking year round. That night, Auntie Bubby told us the story of her last year at school. The teacher decided that they should perform Macbeth, and being the only black kids in the tiny one-teacher school, Auntie Bubby and her two sisters were given the part of witches. Auntie Violet and Auntie Rose and I weren't real thrilled at the beginning, but I convinced them of the importance of the wise sisters, and then they come round and the three of us got really good at our lines, and I made them sit for hours every night with their hands under their chins so they'd go pointy like witches' chins. But when all the kids got sick with scarlet fever and the teacher shut the school down early, they called off the play. Rose and Vi got over it pretty quickly, but I was so disappointed I cried. Auntie Boo laughed and shook her head and said, "Auntie is the only one mad enough to admit she wants to be called a witch." "Why do people hate witches anyway?" I asked. "They're not real." "Oh, they're real all right, doll," Auntie Boo interjected. "They just ain't bad, like people think." Auntie Bubby cleared her throat and said the idea of calling women witches has been around for a long time. Began in a time they called the Middle Ages when there was a deadly illness called the plague. Rats caused it, but nobody knew that at the time. The English were filthy, you know. They lived on top of each other and hated taking baths. Matter of fact was, them fellas only took two baths in their life, one just after they were born and one just before they died. "Well, they still hate taking baths," Auntie Boo added. "What's this got to do with witches?" I could be impatient sometimes. "Hush, child, listen," Auntie Bubby said. She was working up to something, I could tell. "The only people who didn't catch the plague," Auntie Bubby continued, "were lone women living out of town who kept cats for company. The cats kept the rats away, see, and those women didn't catch the plague. And as well as filthy, the English are suspicious, and so they blamed these women for causing the illness in the first place. And townspeople started accusing them lone women of all sorts of things, like having pacts with the devil and practicing evil dark magic. Next thing you know, searchers call witch hunts start all over England and Europe, and these women were rounded up and burnt alive at stakes because the others thought if they got rid of the women, they'd get rid of the plague." Auntie Boo added, "Women living by themselves always easy targets, girl, and for some reason it makes people suspicious to see a woman getting by on her own. And if a woman keeps a cat for company and makes up a few stories to keep strangers away, next thing you know, she's a witch. And a witch hunt is just a way of hunting down those that are different and blaming them for everything that has ever gone wrong in the world." I felt a big lump rising in my throat. "I want to be like everyone else," I pouted, and I curled up in the big armchair that doubled as my bed and buried my head in my knees. Auntie Boo tried another story. She had a passion for quoting philosophers and historians ever since she'd had to read to the old blind Mrs. O'Brien. "Hey, Epictetus told a good story about being different." She paused and took a long whistling breath, and she could switch from home talk to flash talk when she needed to. "And when Epictetus's mates told him he should be more like everyone else, he came back real smart like, and he said to them, 'Because you consider yourself to be only one thread of those that are in a toga, it is fitting that you take care that you should be like the rest of men, just as the thread has no design to be anything superior to other threads. But I wish to be purple, that small part which is bright and makes everything graceful and beautiful. Why then do you tell me to make myself like many? And if I do, how shall I still be purple? I don't care about Epic Waddy's face. I don't want to be purple. I don't want to be black either. My face was burning and I choked back the tears. But Aunty Boo, she laughed and shook her head. Well, you was born to be purple. So be it. And black too, you hear? Well, I couldn't tell them, but I wanted to be white then. Because if I was white, I'd see myself everywhere. In the classroom, when I opened a book or looked at a picture, in the crowded playground, laughing, skipping and jumping between elastics, down the main street or on the movie screen, I'd not stand out from the rest, but purple, black, too hard, too ugly, too different. Thank you.
Thank you. So our next writer is going to be Ellen Van Nerven.
Hello. How's it going? Thank you very much for a beautiful welcome, Corinne. We do feel very welcomed here by everybody that we've come across. We're having a wonderful time. We're learning so much. And just as I hope that you might take a little piece of our stories away with you tonight, we also feel like we're learning from everybody that we meet. I'm going to read a little bit of my book called Heat and Light. Just give you a little bit of a teaser of it and hope maybe you'll go and buy a copy later. No, you don't have to. My book is about families. It's a collection of interlinked short stories. It's about giving everybody in a family a voice to tell their stories. I find that to be able to know your role in a family is so important to your identity, and to know about your culture and history is equally important. A lot of my book features the relationships between children and their parents, children and their grandparents, and about young people learning about their culture and learning how they can fit in into their country. You know, it's about connection to country and connection to nature. And I'm going to read a little bit from a story called Paddles, Not Oars. Keeler sat up cross-legged in his bed as his mother slept. He took his sock off to squish a cocky against the wall. He put his hand out to the window, riding the cold air, and checked the flag was still positioned well. For his 13th birthday, his mother had got him a bag of marshmallows and a second-hand encyclopedia set, A to E. That month, he got a weekend job on the construction site, a block away from their flat, for the new overpass. One afternoon, he headed down by the pier and used marshmallows as bait, thought he'd bring home some dinner. He rubbed the dry mud off his cheek as he waited. His father had told him to read the stars. Hours must have passed, because his mother yelled at him from the beach, flat from walking the blocks, still in her cannery outfit. From now on, I'll get Fran to pick you up. A couple of weeks went by before they got the knock on the door, saying they were tearing down the building and they had 3 weeks to find another place. 3 weeks came and Keeler's mother packed up the car and they got on the highway. Keeler tried to talk to his mother. He watched her grip on the steering wheel. We "We're going to your auntie's," his mother said. Keela's body clenched the safer they got. He could already feel his legs growing cold in his board shorts. With nothing left to do, he read from the encyclopedia until it grew dark outside. They stopped at Coffs that night. His mother parked next to the caravan park by the water. Keela watched the waves skate in. He thought about his father. He saw the canoe in the sky. His mother sat in the back next to him, a blanket over both of them. She told him stories about his father, talking herself to sleep. She'd always sleep before him, and he played his usual night games with himself, counting down numbers, remembering the encyclopedia entries, albino, Banda Banda volcano, CIA, and repeating things his father had told him. There were so many stories that his father had never got to finish. And here, the sky was different. He had gotten through the organizational structure of the CIA when the lights of a vehicle approached. He crawled over the seats and parked himself in the front, pulling his mother's pillow out from underneath him. He didn't need it. He turned the ignition. His father wanted to teach him to drive on his grandmother's property. "When Mum's not around," he had said. She was always around now. The wheel felt heavier than he expected. He reversed back onto the road and drove in the opposite direction to the car, which was coming close. The car would be coppers or the men involved with his father. They're going after him now. He pulled his hair up with sweat. He glanced back at his mother, and she looked changed, even in sleep. The star was heavy in his vision. Back at the old flat, he had listened in on his mother and their neighbour Fran from his bed. "That's how they raise their boys," Fran's voice. "I'm not going to let him go out of control. He's still a boy. 13, he would have been initiated if his father was still with us. There's got to be some control." Keela steadied his hand, put his foot down. The road bent with the bay. He could not see if the car was still behind him. "He hasn't struck you, has he?" Fran's hushed voice. "He takes my wallet when he doesn't want me to leave the house. He moved everyone's things out of the garage one day into the neighbours upstairs because it was going to flood." "Did it?" A pause. "Yeah, you remember that crazy storm? The worst we had. Our street always cops it." Keela drove faster. He was ready. He went roughly around a corner. He heard his mother's stir. He thought about looking at her again, but he couldn't lose his focus. "He's a big boy," Fran had said. "He doesn't look 13. "He's gone through too much," his mother had said. "And I'm losing him." The car was not unlike his bed in their old flat. He was stirring them towards a star, towards his father. Thank you.
Next is Jared Thomas.
Okay. Yeah, thank you so much for the welcome. Thank you all for being here. We've been having a great time in America, and Virginia's just beautiful, in Charlottesville. I'm going to be talking a little bit about my home, my country, and my family, because it really is the inspiration for my writing. So I'm a Nukuna person, but I'm also of Ngadri heritage, and I'm also of European heritage, so English and Scottish heritage as well. So I live in the Southern Flinders Ranges, which is between the coast and the ranges. So here are some of my family, and this is us sitting by the coastline. There's my father, my auntie. These are all my uncles, cousins. And this was one day a couple of years ago. Some of the men in my family, my dad, my uncles, cousins. This is some of our mountain range, so it's quite beautiful, really rugged mountain range, and it stretches for several hundred kilometres. Shot from the coast, and this is within the range itself. So we're in the driest continent, the driest state on the planet, so water is incredibly important to us, and knowledge about water is incredibly important as well. This is on one of our properties, so we manage over 4,500 hectares of our traditional land. So as a family, we manage it together. One of these people is a really famous Australian. It's my uncle Lindsay Thomas, my dad's brother. The other person is Russell Crowe. So in terms of taking care of country, there's many things that we do. From sharing stories, but also in this case, Uncle Lindsay's helping Russell with the film The Water Diviner, and just looking at how to shoot within our country in a respectful way, so people aren't shooting sites they shouldn't be at and disturbing particular places. So this is a shot from Baruta, and that's where a lot of my family lived as soon as we were colonised. So we still have that particular property. Part of the conditions of that property was that the men had to go and work, the children had to go get a Western education, but the women could stay. But it's remained that cultural hub of our people for over a century since colonisation. This is Uncle Lindsay and I a fortnight ago, and we're on our property, and we're actually looking after the place. We're not burning it down. So it's very wet, but in the next month or so, as we go into spring, it'll get terribly dry, and the fuel is dangerous. And here what we're trying to do is spur on the wattle seed so we have some good growth over the summer. So I write a lot about, family, culture, sharing stories, and reconnection of people, because unfortunately there's been a real... some of us have been disconnected through the government policy, and a lot of people are coming back, and they have a right to their culture, and we have a responsibility to show them how to come back to their culture as well. Another of my novels, which is out the front. So if I can just close that down, and I'm just going to read you a little section from the novel Calypso Summer, which features a cover of a picture of my cousin Trent on the front. And this story is about how do we bring our young people back and make sure that they're learning about our history. Because I was a kid that was raised with BMX bikes and Star Wars and computer games, but I was very lucky to grow up on my country and to be learning. And I want to ensure that there's other Nukuna people have those same opportunities. So told from the perspective of Kyle, who gets called Calypso. Bloody crows woke me up as soon as it was light, squawking their asses off from the big gum trees in Auntie Janet's backyard. I tried covering my head with the pillow, but they kept at it. Wakala, wakala. So I unzipped my sleeping bag, stood up and stretched. When I opened my eyes, I was looking onto the hills, a slither of faint blue light hovering over them, and the morning star sitting there. Uncle Ray was snoring next to the smouldering coals of last night's fire. I slipped into my shoes and started walking around Auntie Janet's place, real quiet way. I snuck off to the big shed with its open front, looking ready to swallow up the yard. Even though it was dark in there, when I got closer, I could see all this farm equipment, a truck and that. It was all real old, hadn't been used in ages. There was a loose bit of iron on the side of the shed that flapped and creaked with a little wind coming off the ocean. I opened the gate to let myself into Auntie Janet's block. The sun was coming up. I walked the fence line noticing the different plants around the place. Auntie Janet's front yard was covered in trees and small shrubs. After walking the front yard, I followed a dirt track into the centre of some trees clumped together. Those fellas looked like they'd been planted there deliberately. Their trunks weren't real fat, just kind of as wide as a cricket bat, baseball bat, and double my height. Their bark all dark and rough. The leaves were skinny and real healthy looking. Covering the ground were these seeds. The surface looked like how your fingertips get all wrinkly when you've been in the ocean too long. I bent down and picked one up. There was a bit of hard skin stuck to it that I peeled off before flicking the seed, thinking it would make a good marble. Then I ran my hand over some of the leaves and held my hand to my nose. I couldn't smell nothing. With all those seeds on the ground, I thought that whatever had been growing on the tree must be long gone. But then I stood closer to the trunk and saw a couple of fruits. I guess they were still hanging around. They were kind of rotten too, with only a bit of red skin hanging off, like they'd been eaten by bugs and things and withered. I reached out to grab one. When I almost had it between my fingers, I felt a slap on the back of my hand. I turned around ready for a fight, and there was Vic standing back, laughing at me. "What the hell are you doing? What the hell are you doing sneaking up on me like that?" I said. "No, what the hell are you doing sneaking around the yard and these ooties?" The crows woke me up. "Yeah, well, they don't trust you either." "Oh, get off it, Vic. I'm just checking things out." "But that's what you came here to do, eh? Check things out. Take back to your boss. You got to learn you just can't take things without asking. Can't just cruise around without asking. What do you expect me to do? Just lay there awake and listen to Uncle Ray snoring?" I was well and truly awake now. Vic screwed up his face and seemed to be considering my question. "There's big things in this country, special things, and everywhere you go, someone's watching you. Lots of people watching you. They'll get you too if you don't be careful." "Who?" I asked. "Old spirit people. They make you sick if you do the wrong thing." "What? You mean by just picking one of these seeds here?" Vic laughed. "If Bob Marley was singing about those seeds, you'd know what it was called, eh? You'd be smoking that bloody thing." "So what is it then?" I asked, raising my voice at Vic. "Smoke it and see. I'm not going to tell you. We've been here forever. We didn't go away nowhere. We grew up here. We went to school over there," Vic said, pointing the direction of town, "with all those other kids giving us a hard time about our black skin, our curly hair, our goddamn being so poor. And what? You with your rich white old dad living in the city with all your rust to shit? You ought to be ashamed just coming back here asking for things, taking things." "My dad died when I was a kid," I said, really wild, as I'd never had to defend myself because of a dad I hardly remembered. "Well, I'm sorry about that, but still, what do you know about this country?" "Nothing, Vic," I shut down. My mind was on Mum and the things she'd told me. "This country is sacred. There's special things everywhere." "Well, if you tell me where not to go, I won't go there." "How can I trust you? You're already sneaking around." "Well, look, I'll go lie back down. When I get up, if you want me to follow you around like your shadow, that's what I'll do." "I respect what you're saying, Vic," I swallowed and said, "but I like it here and I will be coming back." "Why don't you just go back to your flash mob job in the city and all your white women and that? What do you want to come around taking shit from us for? We've already had enough taken from us." "You've got the wrong idea, cuz." I turned to walk back to my spot alongside Uncle Ray, snoring next to the smouldering coals with his cowboy hat covering his eyes. Thank you.
And next we're going to hear from Deborah Miranda. This is like speed dating in literature.
What was that?
It's like speed dating in literature, you know, it's kind of a quick snip of everybody's work.
Yeah, okay. I'll try to snip away.
No, you don't have to be.
I'm going to read a little something from Bad Indians, a tribal memoir. It's a long story. It starts in 1770 and goes to the present. trying to kind of trace the experience of my family as they went into and survived, some of them, the missions in California. You've probably heard recently that a priest named Junipero Serra is going to be canonized by the Catholic Church this month. He was the founder of the California missions, and our mission in Carmel, San Carlos, or the Carmel mission, was the mission he chose as his home place. So I have many, many ancestors who were baptized and taught by Junipero Serra. And I have a bone to pick with Pope Francis about this. I do not particularly feel that he is the best man, the best candidate for sainthood. We did not have a good experience with the Catholic Church. We went in about 1 million strong, and we came out about 20,000 in 65 years. So that was a pretty harsh environment. But in California, Father Serra is already sainted many times over. And the missions are a touristic place. They're very much rebuilt, and all fourth graders in California have to do a fourth grade mission project where they pick one of the 21 missions, make a little model out of it, and write a report about it. I left California when I was 5, so I missed doing my mission project. So this book is kind of the replacement for that. Within the book, I have a little section called My Mission Glossary, excerpts from a very late fourth grade project. I have definitions for adobe bricks and for bells and for different kinds of discipline, like flogging and the cat o' nine tails and the korma, which was a form of stocks. And one of the things I define is the padre. What does padre mean to a mission Indian? And I have a little picture to go along with it. There's an excerpt from Zephyrin Engelhart, who was a Catholic historian, and he says, "The neophyte, or the converted, community was like one great family, at the head of which stood the padre. To him, the Indians looked for everything concerning their bodies as well as their souls. He was their guide and their protector." The padre baptized us, gave us names and godparents. He taught us our catechism, officiated at our first communion, posted our marriage bans, performed our weddings, baptized our babies, administered last rites, listened to our confessions. He punished us when we prayed to the wrong God or tired of our wives and husbands. He taught us to sing. Our own songs were ugly. He taught us to speak. Our own languages were nonsensical. He made us wear clothes. Our bodies were shameful. He gave us wheat and the plow. Seeds and acorns were fit only for animals. Yes, that padre, he was everything to us Indians. At the giving end of a whip, he taught us to care for and kill cattle, work fields of wheat and corn and barley, make adobe walls for our own prisons, build the church, the monjerio, storerooms, promised it all to us if we would just grow up, pray hard enough, forget enough. But it all went to Spain, to Rome, to Mexico, into the pockets of merchants, smugglers, priests, dishonest administrators, and finally the cruel Americans. Nothing left for the children the padre had worked so hard to civilize, poor savages pulled from the fires of certain hell. He was our shepherd. We were his beloved and abused flock. Now the fields are eaten down to earth. We claw the earth, yet even the roots are withered and the shepherd has gone away. But we are pagans no more. Now we are Christian vaqueros, Christian housekeepers, Christian blacksmiths and shoemakers and laundry women and wet nurses and handymen. None of us paid more than a meal or a shirt or a pair of discarded boots, but Christians. Poor Christians, drunken Christians, meek targets for 49ers crazed by gold lust or ranchers hungry for land. We are homeless Christians, starving Christians, diseased and landless Christians. We are Christian slaves bought and sold on
bought and sold in newspapers on auction blocks in San Francisco, Los Angeles, $100 for a likely girl, $50 for an able-bodied boy, free to whoever bails out the old men from jail. Every one of us baptized by the Padre, our primitive souls snatched from this hell our bodies cannot escape. We are Christian, we are Catholic, we are saved by the Padres, and for that, Jesus Christ, we must be grateful. You might sense a little bit of a chip on my shoulder. I'm going to read something a little cheerier from towards the end. My sister Louise is chair of our tribe. She has done a great deal to bring back our language, and I follow in her footsteps pretty much as a kindergartner. But I went to an amazing conference at UC Berkeley called Breath of Life, which is an organization that works to bring linguists and California Indians together so that we can find records and retrieve our languages. So we say our languages are not dead, they're only sleeping, and it's our job to wake them up. So this is my first poem in the Esalen language. It's called Teheya Pamia Chiska, Giving Honor, for my sister Louise and for the Breath of Life Language Conference. Ani micha elpa mishmach hanano, I feel you in my blood. Nishtiyano nishiti anhano, nishachurno, in my bones, my gut, my teeth. Name sikosura niche alki, you rise all around. Kolopistik hulinopa, return like a lover. Nishku'u niche lahake, my basket, carry me. Nishimila, niche lesapka, my ocean, bathe me. Ani namai ekhunu manipsha, I am your hummingbird. Name hiiata neku masianek, you are the flower of the heart. Name cha'a nishkaha sakano, I feel you in my head. Nish hushuno, nish keleno, my hands, my feet. Uharat kai pere, we dance on the cliff of the world. Name cha'a nish cha sa hikano, I feel you in my spine. Nish hoksno, nish tihikano, my throat, my womb. Name sana kakopa, eni inam kakopa, you are a river, I am the rain. Bantuhite, mantuhite, it is true. It is true. Mantuhite, mantuhite. It is true. It is true. Nishwelel, lechwelel. My language, our language. Maksiri maknoko, breath of life. Thank you. This is just one poem from my newest book, Raised by Humans. Sometimes you wish you'd been raised by wolves. This is another poem that has some resonances with the sort of the colonization that happened during missionization, the way that the Catholic Church had pulls on us. It's called Rosary. Put me on a train. Let me ride all the way from San Diego to Sacramento. Let me watch the lands I love unroll like a scroll, a story that keeps opening and opening, rich and full of sky, sand, oaks, hills, oceans, pines, snow. Let me drink in the old voices living here. Let the old knowledge seep back into me. Feast my eyes, I am a glutton, unable to turn away, not wanting to sleep. Let the train rock me back and sleep, back and forth, jostle me over a rough spot in the track. Let the steel wheels beneath the floor whine and sing. Let the long, slow grades ease us down from the mountains like a snake on a summer day, silver scales sparkling in the sun. Put me on a train. Let the world shrink down to this one ragged coastline. Let this narrow corridor become the only world that matters. Rumbling through Los Angeles, I'll look for the dry cement banks of the river we have never forgotten. See homeless souls living in the mouths of drains that haven't seen a drop of water in months. They know what they're doing. Blue tarps over the entrance, a battered lawn chair. Would I manage as well? If I knew how to pray, I would pray for them, those people who never pray for rain. San Juan Capistrano, San Fernando Rey de España, Santa Barbara. Let me pass by the adobe missions, the ridiculously renovated, the melting rubble, with tender thoughts for the souls of my ancestors. Like clay and stone, we transform. This is the string of miracles I follow. Thanks.
We're going to hear from Doug Leffler next.
Hi, how are we? You guys can understand our accents? Yeah, I have to thank, first I have to honor the Monican and Karen and Deborah for your beautiful languages. That's, as languages leave a great resonance, it's something to be cherished. And I thank everybody here for coming to hear us. That means a lot. I wrote this book once I was a boy, and it's on one hand it's a simple tale, a tale of friendship and a tale of love, and on the other hand it's it is about a segment of Australian history, of Aboriginal history, unfortunately, and it was called the Stolen Generations, and it was the forced removal of Aboriginal children from their family, something that I know firsthand. Once there was a boy that lived on an island. He lived there all by himself. He lived in an ancient boat made from an ancient tree right on the beach. No, it's okay, it's okay. Not a bad boat. Every morning he got up and picked fruit. His favourite fruit was called sapote, and it tasted just like chocolate. It's a real fruit, and it does taste like chocolate. He loved climbing in the mangrove trees and watching the sun light up the sea. And one day, as he was sitting high in the mangrove tree eating some sapotes, he looked down the beach. He saw something moving. A tiny little speck coming down the beach. Closer. Closer and closer. Someone else here on the island. Hello, came a little voice. Hello, said the boy. Who are you? I'm a girl, said the girl below the mangrove tree. And the boy dropped all his sapotes on the ground in surprise. And one of them landed in the girl's hands. And she took a huge bite. Mmm, yum. These are delicious. And with that, she ate up all the sapotes one by one. Eating all that fruit has made me sleepy, the girl said. Can I sleep up there? She asked, pointing to the ancient boat made from the ancient tree. Before the boy could answer, the girl had climbed up and fallen fast asleep in his softest hammock. He thought, watching her sleep. He watched her as it became dark. He watched her all through the night. And he wondered what would happen in the morning. Would she stay? Before first light, he slipped out. The girl woke up to find herself alone. There was a note on the table. The note said, "Good morning. I hope you had a good sleep. I've gone to the other side of the island to get some more sapotes for breakfast. I'll be back home soon. Please make yourself at home. Oh, P.S. Don't look under my bed." The girl's imagination started jumping up and down. What could be under his bed? No, I must not look. Not even a little look, she thought. Soon she found herself kneeling down and looking under the boy's bed, for there, tucked away in the dark, was an old box. It was a strange box. It was small and was made from wood. The girl touched it and she pulled it out from under the bed. The thump came a sound from the box. The thump, the thump, the thump. The little girl jumped back in fright. She jumped on the box and then it unlocked. The girl's eyes opened wide, for there inside it was a heart, and the heart was beating. The thump went the heart. The thump. The thump. I've never been this close to a boy's heart before, she thought. She decided to pick it up. And as the girl held the boy's heart in her hands, the boy came bursting through the door and said, "Good morning." So, startled, she dropped it and broke it. I'll have to leave it there, I think. So I think it's out the front. Thank you.
And now we're going to hear from Bruce Pascoe.
What Dub does is almost illegal in our country. I really appreciate the welcome to country. It's important to us, and I also thoroughly enjoyed the reading about country. This is from a novel called Bloke, which is also out the front, and it talks about an old lady going to sleep. I hope it doesn't work too well. This section has been turned into a short film called Black Chooks. When I came back, the house was quiet, just a slit of light from the firebox door. I put tea in the pot and poured water from the simmering kettle. I waited for for the tea to draw, standing by the stove, letting its warmth surround me, comfort me. I wouldn't mind a cup myself. I spun around, saw the faint outline of Auntie Cook up in the chair. You've been for a walk? I had a beer. I met the butcher and his mate. He's a good bloke. My oath he is. Robin Hood, that man. Make sure a black man's meat is a little bit heavier. Few more snags or chops. Good man. There was a little weasel man there, reckons you're a communist. Thank Christ for that. I thought he hated me. It was good to have a yarn. Yeah, you need that, Jim. I seen you boys come home after your holiday, all emptiness, restless and cranky. I've always been a loner, Aunt. But you chose that. Different when they force it on you. I poured two cups of tea. What about some toast as well, eh? Make a bit of a picnic. I cut bread, lifted the damper on the stove and cooked the toast on the hot plate. Ah, blackfella toast, she sighed. You'd better get that honey Darce gave me. I knew the jar. It was real dark honey with little black bees embalmed in it like Chinese jewels, native bees. She actually licked her lips as I passed the plate of toast. You know, Jim, when we were kids, we hardly ever got white food. Flour and sugar and tea, but everything else was out of the bush. Rabbit, roux, fish, cabbage. There's no music like that in the film, I can tell you. Cobra, duck, snake, oysters, mussels. Oh, we never thought we was poor until we went to school and the other kids laughed at us. We might have an apple and a piece of rabbit leg for lunch and those white kids would piss themselves laughing. It hurt, you know, because we loved our parents. Hated to hear them shamed, especially by snotty little kids. That's why I love this black tucker. She saluted me with a slice of toast. Yeah, I seen you boys come back lonely and loose, trouble brewing like last week's stew. I went into town the other day as witness for one of Jemmy's boys, been in for 6 weeks for stealing some bloke. Gets out and within a week he's inside for stealing another car. Wasn't his car, but them mongrels let down his tyres. Locked it and pinched his keys. Ah, big joke, eh? So he borrows one in the car park. Bloke reports it stolen, doesn't realise it was someone in his own footy club. Didn't want to press charges, but then they asked this bloke about the stash in his car, the underage girl. They had him. Made him press charges. That's the sort of work grinds me down, Jim. Arguing to keep a young boy out of jail when he was just wild and stupid and thought he could trust his mates. That's when you realise the colour difference. That's when the anger burns. That's why you have to bottle it. You can't afford to get angry, Jim, because last time you did, they done you, and they're itching to do it again. We need you with us, Jim, this side of the fence. Inside, you're just more work for us. More worry, less hands to do the work. She took a long draught of her cooling tea, stared at the cup. Go a bit cold in you, aunt. Yeah, she said hopefully. I'll make you another one. Oh, it's a good picnic, this. She even smiled at me, but in the light from the stove, it looked a bit like the snarl from the Gippsland Panther. You're not a bad bloke, Jim, you know that. You and Retha would be all right and never hurts to have a black marry black. But you got the holiday lonelies, Jim, and you can't trust that. You spent all those years in the home and then all those years inside and you can't trust what you feel as soon as you get out. You got the lonelies, and woman lonelies is the worst kind. And besides, you got that other woman. Is that right? She's your age and you found her. You courted her, Jim. Get that look off your face. We know a lot of things. Nugget went down to Nullarkin trying to suss out Stoker and Brass. People told him stuff. We all know that fishing mob. We work for plenty of them. Treat us better than most white people. Mainly because some of them aren't all that white. So that means you can give me advice on romance. That's a woman's prerogative. Aunt's duty. Black woman's right. Never saw that in the Constitution. In the Constitution, it lists us under flora and fauna. For a lady who never went to school, you know a lot. I learnt to read, Jim. And for lonely people, reading is liberty. You lonely aren't. You wouldn't know the half of it, Jim. We looked at each other in the faint flickering light of the stove, and don't you tell no one about what I said. About Jimmy's boy's car. No, smart ass. The lonelies, mine and yours. All my mob think I'm strong as an ox. No need for them to know otherwise. Don't know why I told you. Too much tea. Well, you're probably right. Aren't too many ever made me a cup of tea, and when they do, I appreciate it. I nodded, embarrassed. On the outside, Jim, that's where we want you, picking up the slack and helping us poor old people. Geez, Aunt, I hope you're not going to go and sook on me. Sook? No time for black people to sook. We finished the tea and toast, and I took the plates and cups to the sink. I could hear the old lady squirming down into the chair. I glanced over my shoulder. She was a big woman, but was wriggling down into the arms of the battered chair like a child. You going to bed, Aunt? No, I'll stay here now, next to me fire. I often sleep out here. Good place to think. Well, good night, Aunt. Jim, there's one thing I want you to do. I looked at the kettle. I just filled it with cold water. I want you to be an old man. Outside. Sorry to nag you, but if you do that, I'll lie down by your mother, a happy woman. She turned away from me, and just as well. I turned off the light and in the sudden darkness waited for my eyes to adjust and pick out the edges of furniture lit by the gleam from the stove door. Her voice began again, deep and muffled by the cushion. Of course they'll hate you for it, Jim. You just wait, choosing black over white. Been the same since day one. Just couldn't believe we didn't want to be white. Couldn't believe we preferred our own life, our own way of sleeping in chairs. She just ignored my attempt to lighten it a bit. They want us to be grateful. There's some good people about. I'm not stupid. I can see that. People who do you a good turn when it suits them. But they're always waiting for us to kiss their hand. Kiss their hand? Well, I know they're not all like that. I know not all. But I can't give in to not all. We have to keep our pride, Jim. Not go all gooey when they give us a break. Let us have a broken down mill house. Let us have a bloody rotten house on our own land. This is a good old house, aren't it? Are you listening, Jim? I heard her sit up in the chair, probably turned to face me, but not even the edge of her cheek could be seen. It's not about the house or a second-hand armchair that no one wants anymore. It's the fact that they want you to love them, love their bloody Christian generosity. They want us to see their superiority of their love and their charity, their Christian goodness, and I won't bloody do that because it just encourages them. I don't want to be white. I think you've had success there. I don't want a garden like theirs, a house like theirs, manners like theirs. I want my old granny's manners. I want my old man's food. But they want me to aspire. The last word hung in the air between us. I heard the hesitation as she searched for it, and she drew a breath on account of it. Aspire to their way of life, and I won't, because that means they were right to pinch our land. As soon as they come along, we want their church, their lace, their bloody washing powder. No one's got whiter washing than you, aren't? Yeah, I'm famous for me whites. But that's just so they can't point the finger. I never go past without buying a raffle ticket for the old folks' home neither. I want to pull me weight so they can never point the finger, so that when I refuse to be white, they know it's not because I can't wash a fucking tablecloth. The dark surrounded us, the strip of light at the edge of the stove door, our only comfort. I heard her squirming in the chair again, bedding down. They'll hate you for not choosing white, Jim. Just warning you, it'll never be easy. They'll always be waiting for you to trip up, to prove their way is best. That's why it's lonely. That's why you get tired and have to sleep in a chair. I sleep here so I can feel the fire in my face. reminds them in the old days, that's all. And you'd better go back to your shed. I'm just warning you about the hall ahead, that's all. No use pulling out later because the going gets tough. We can't afford to be looking over our shoulder all the time, wondering where you are. I'm over here in the dark. We're all in the dark, my countrymen. We need you to pull your weight, Jim. You're either black or you're not. But if you're black, then you wake up black and you go to bed black. And in between, you're working for the mob. You seen the butcher, eh? Is he just cutting up meat? No, he's a good lad. He's proven to him that he can cut the mustard, proven that he can run a business, look after his wife and kids, but any time there's a sports day or dance, he gives us the meat. We don't have to ask. He's a black man and he's proud of it. Doesn't have to wear badges and ribbons to prove he's black. He just is, and he's working for his people. When you're black, you're never free, because there's 200 years of spade work to do. You want me to cut up some snags, aren't you? Don't try and joke out of it, Jim. I'm not in the mood. You got that education. Not a bloody apprenticeship. Sausages will keep us alive, but we can't fight the bloody authorities with famous corned beef recipes. That girl, Charlie's daughter, you've seen what she done. She made a film about us people, made them bastards watch it, with a will and a mind, and that's what we need, educated people to argue. We need water in the river. Don't sneer at an old lady doing her best. I'm not sneering, Aunt. Just as well, because that's the sort of thing we need. Why is there no bloody water in the river? Because the greedy bastards use it all. Couldn't bear to see any of it run past their fence. We have to teach them about the country they live in. Teach them how to look after it. We sat in silence, both of us leaning forward, watching the crack of light below the stove door. That's all.
So I want to start tonight by reading a poem that acknowledges our guests. And Jeb referred to the stolen generation in Australia. Unfortunately, that experience wasn't unique to Australia. It happened all over the world. There's an interesting documentary called Schooling the World, if you're interested in knowing just how pervasive that was. This poem is called Apologies, and it's in three parts. One, the time has come for the nation to turn a new page by righting wrongs of the past. We apologize for laws and policies that inflicted profound grief, suffering, and loss, and for the removal of children from families, communities, and country. For the pain of these, their descendants, and for families left behind, to mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, for indignity inflicted on a proud people, we say sorry. We resolve that the injustices of the past must never, never happen again, and look to a future based on mutual respect, where all, whatever their origins, are equal partners. Spoken by Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, introduced in January and delivered November 29, 2008, the day after he was sworn into office. Two, I stand before you today to offer an apology to former students of Indian residential schools whose objectives assumed that Aboriginal cultures and spiritual beliefs were inferior and unequal. This policy of assimilation was wrong, caused great harm, and has no place in our country. Young children were forcibly removed from their homes. Many were inadequately fed, clothed, and housed. Some died. Others never returned home. Many have told of emotional, physical, and sexual abuse and neglect and their separation from powerless families. To living former students, family members, and communities, we recognize our wrong in separating children from their cultures. We apologize for failing to protect you. We ask the forgiveness of Aboriginal peoples for failing them so profoundly. spoken by Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper in the House of Commons, June 11, 2008. 3. The United States, acting through Congress, recognizes years of official depredations, ill-conceived policies, and the breaking of covenants by the government, apologizes to all Native peoples for the many instances of violence, maltreatment, and neglect inflicted on them, urges the President to acknowledge wrongs against Indian tribes in order to bring healing to this land, and adds this disclaimer, nothing herein authorizes or supports any claim or serves as a settlement against the United States. Introduced by Senator Sam Brownback, then attached to a defense appropriations bill, the U.S. apology resolution was signed in April 2010 and remains undelivered aloud by the President. This next one, I'm going to bring it home. This next one is called Abracadabra, an Abecedarian. And an Abecedarian is a poem in which each subsequent line starts with a sequential letter of the alphabet. It turned out it was very easy to write because I was very angry when I wrote it. It's not so easy to read and it's not so easy to hear, but I think for that reason I have to do it. All this time I've been looking for words for certain difficult women because they aren't able to speak for themselves, and now the Clinton Foundation has come up with a brilliant campaign. They decided for International Women's Day through digital magic to erase women on the cover of Condé Nast, posters, billboards, those figures replaced by empty space because women have not yet achieved gender equity. As noted on a website, notthere.org, and they're right, we haven't. But when I read about notthere.org and saw its flashy graphics, I wasn't thinking about how women are not there yet, metaphorically. I just thought about women who are really not there, women and girls who keep disappearing, not from magazines, who don't make news in Manhattan, like they've evaporated, like illusions, hundreds in Juarez, 1,200 missing and murdered Native women across Canada, the hands of men. Now you see her, not there, not here either, or anywhere. Maybe just part of the problem is the predatory perpetrator, prestidigitator, who more often than not knows her, knows how to keep her quiet, who may claim to love her even, maybe getting even, or the serial rapist killer in the bushes, who bushwhacks her in the dark. You're always safe, says the forensic psychiatrist, unless a monster happens to show up, and then you're not there. Maybe a lonely mandible, maxilla, fibula, or ulna shows up, or a bagged body gets dragged from the river, or not. Is this the value we permit a woman's life to have or not have throughout a wrong world? A global idea of her as disposable parts. In the end, this is not a xenophobic poem, not specific, it's everywhere, not there, right here. Yes, the sun rises anyway, but now the parents are staring past each other, that zero between them, like a chalked outline in their family photograph, or not. And now I can't leave you like that because that's just sad. And so I want to read another one. These are all from the new book called Weaving the Boundary, and this is called To Keep Faith. It's an idea like light, the star's trajectory over sacred places that rise from their landscapes, dark mesa, dark desert tower, dark river swelling across the shadowed fields of the Republic. This is your passion to save the Earth's cathedrals. The machinery of our country's interest works against it. In another city, you might have disappeared, blindfolded at sunrise with hands behind your back. In another time, not that long ago, I might have found you face up in a field of silence among the still beautiful bodies of Dakota men. To speak for the earth, I say history is against us here, as though you hadn't already recalled who I was before I learned to be wary of stories or as though your words hadn't entered me like light, small wave caps rising on all that darkness. For you, then, some words about light, relentless light, incantatory words we could lick like blue flames, words to keep faith with each other and earth, that searing love which still claims us. I'm going to read you one more from my book, Markings on Earth, just because I love this poem and it's starting to feel like this time of year. And because it's important that I acknowledge my elders, the women who came before me, and how beautiful they are. When I worked for our tribe, we decided that we wanted to do some economic projects that would help us to raise money. And one of the things our women do very well is make apple butter and jelly. And so we were going to sell apple butter and jelly in these beautiful gift baskets. And what we found out was that the women didn't care at all about making money. They liked to come together in the kitchen so that they could talk and cook together. And so it was quite a beautiful experience for me to learn how to make apple butter from my elders. In late September evenings, bring Monican women to the tribal center kitchen where they make apple butter. They gather their aprons, headscarves tied on, descending the hillsides with dusk. The first night, they pair core and quarter cooking apples, imperfect yellow spheres stacked in bushel baskets, no crimson wax delicious, no green Granny Smiths, no empires. All evening, women chop as apple chunks turn the color of earth in the air, as leaves begin to yellow in the darkness. They need 1 quart of apples for every half pint, baskets empty as fingers grow moist, then wrinkle among laughter and the scrapes of small knives that pair and pair again. The second night, boiling begins. Scents of hot cider, cinnamon, ginger, and cloves rise to spread around the women like thick hooded robes. Quarts of cider or vinegar are stirred and stirred again. The hours it takes to reduce each pot by half, to add the chopped apples, simmer an hour, add sugar, spices, boil again until dark gold mixtures turn the mahogany velvet of trees. And the scent anoints the hair. Now, through the music of spoons, jars, and pots, through laughter, what remains is reduced to the essence of apple, roots and limbs laden with gold circles. We are blessed by the hands of these women who ladle into jars an enchantment made by heart, who condense, seal, process, and sell apple butter at St. Paul's Church Bazaar, $3 for a pint. Thank you. So what we're hoping to do now is to have a bit of a conversation, and perhaps you have some questions that have accumulated in your mind for some of the readers. And if you would like, please feel free to ask them and wait for the mic to come around, because we are podcasting this and audio recording it. And then after we're finished, we hope that you'll join us for a reception outside. So, questions? We've struck you speechless.
Thank you very much. Incredibly moving. It's an honor to be here with all of you. I'm wondering if you'd be able to address the nature of storytelling as far as your medicine people or in the healing realms of your traditions.
Anybody want to take that?
So you're talking about storytelling as healing and medicine, or you're talking about people that have knowledge about medicine and how they tell stories? Okay, well, I guess let's forget about healing. Let's just talk about being healthy, okay? So that we're not sick, we're using story to remain strong. So in Nukuna culture, we say, "Yura muda, our word for the dreaming. So you may have heard of a concept called the dreaming or the dream time in relation to Aboriginal Australia. So we talk about Yura and Muta. So Yura is person, Muta is earth. So it's the reciprocation between people and the earth. You give to the earth, that the earth will give back to you. Okay, so in Nookana country, as I said, it's a driest state, driest continent on earth. We also happen to have about 10 of the most deadly snakes in the world. We've got white pointer sharks. So everything's pretty much out to get you, okay?
You want people to come, don't you?
Yeah. But so our storytelling tells us about how to live in that particular environment so that we stay healthy, so that we're not bitten by the snake, we're not dehydrated, we know how to get good food, we know the differences between good and bad food. So I'm not a medicine person, okay? Like, we haven't had our full initiation ceremonies since the 1920s. We retain as much culture as what we can. But storytelling, yes, it's used as to keep us strong, to enable us to have cultural strength, knowledge of land, and also to know our connections with our family and our neighbours as well. So, again, with Nookana country, we're surrounded by various other language groups or tribes, might be the term used in America, and it's stories about how to relate with our neighbours. We say that within Australia, there's been peace for 4,000 years. Okay, so those stories enabled us, the development of those stories enabled to reach a time of peace. Those stories meant that we weren't fighting over resources. We've evolved to that level that we weren't fighting over resources. So, stories help us to remain strong and balanced.
I would just also thank you all so much for coming. I work primarily in the colonial period and in the Americas, so I'm having serious chronological envy of my colleagues who get to talk to the authors that they study. I took a lot of notes and I learned a lot, but one thing that struck me is the tremendous range of genres that you've presented tonight. You showed us a variety of prose fiction, short story, novel, children's literature, image, various kinds of poetry in multiple languages, and I'm wondering if you can just comment on how you choose the genres that allow you to tell the kinds of stories that matter. Thanks.
Thanks. When I just speak personally, like, my work that I read from is a collection of women's stories, which are not traditional dreaming stories. They're very important, but they're actually the stories of resilience. And there's three stories of three generations of women here. And so I personally, and in my poetry as well, was less conscious of genre. That's something my publisher did, I guess. And I was more focusing on the dialogue and the voice of those particular stories. And the same with the poetry. What was driving it in the first instance was not that I want to write this poetry for a particular audience. It's like, this poetry is the most appropriate way to tell a family history, and I don't consider the poetry actually as fiction, which is interesting. Outside of creative writing, I'm a researcher, and a lot of my research is looking at non-Western ways, or pioneering a bit of a non-Western way to look and to read and to analyse Aboriginal writing, which looks at the writing first, or what it has to say, rather than how to classify it in a Western model. So I guess a short answer to your story was that I was thinking of messages and stories when I was writing, rather than genre. And I kind of find that issue of genre, I know that publishers have to do it, and I know it's a necessary part in some ways of publishing or marketing a book. But and I, through my research, had the great privilege of speaking to a number of writers. And I think what I've discovered is a lot of the work is actually message-driven, story-driven first. And then that may take the shape that's a familiar Western genre.
What you're seeing today is an explosion of the genres that First Nation Australians are writing in. You know, it's, you know, we write in every genre, and you know, about 30 years ago, poetry and life stories and really political work were the genres that our writers wrote in, but also the genres that we were expected to write in and that mainstream allowed us to write in. Now you see the variety of what we're working across, and when we have writers that are working in fantasy, romance, and crime, really, you know, just bringing that Aboriginal perspective to those genres. And I write poetry, fiction, essay. I feel poetry is very much the personal, the everyday. Fiction, these are people that come to me. Fiction's also, for me, writing back to country. And then the essays, me thinking with a kind of a wider perspective, looking at the country, looking at how to agitate for change. So I think it feels like my stories find their right place to sit. Yeah, and I know that some of us also write across genres, but what about you, Dub? Why do you choose the genres that you work in?
I guess there's the concept of first contact, and so, you know, writing kids' books, and that's a way of owning that contact. And you know, you remember the books that you grew up on, you grew up reading, and that can really affect, you know, you to adulthood. And I'd been illustrating children's books for quite a few years before I started writing, and that sort of, yeah, I'd read the stories, and I just, because I would often work in metaphor, so I thought I might as well just write to metaphor and then compound it with illustration. So that way, and the method is inclusion, not exclusion. So sort of just touching the surface and then it's an invitation, and so, you know, hopefully that's the gateway that you'd read, say, my books, and then it would lead you to other people's books. And so, yeah.
I think there's some parallels with lots of other marginalised groups in the world, particularly, you know, I sort of look at the African American situation where when you start writing, you know, literature comes in song first, and in terms of, you know, resistance and hype, and then you move to the more resistance-based genres like poetry, and then biographies and autobiographies just save people's stories so that there's a presentation of stories. I think where we come in now, and I've parallel to the African American and to other marginalised groups, is that you start to move through, and once you start to create your own stories and create your own destiny, it means that you're actually starting to turn the circle and not just relying on telling the story of what the past is, but now you're creating what the future is. And I think that's what we're saying is an explosion in Aboriginal literature. That's what we're moving toward, is we're starting to create our own destiny.
I just wanted to add, too, that sometimes what I've noticed with North American Indigenous people is a move towards sort of a multi-genre approach, where there is a mix of poetry and prose. Sometimes with somebody like Joy Harjo or Linda Hogan, you can't even tell the difference between their poetry and their prose. It's so image-based. But when I was working on Bad Indians, I was using those sort of archival records in which the Native voices is absent and yet has left, you know, there's a story there. And so I was mining newspapers and mission documents, ethnographer notes, stories from my grandfather and father. I even, on the inside cover, have these things that are called... that my mother actually got from the BIA. It's called a chart for calculating quantum of Indian blood. And, you know, it's one of those things that has, you know, the little graph. And so I was sitting with them one night and drawing, and I decided to, you know, tell somebody what else you could do with your chart for calculating the quantum of Indian blood. And, you know, reappropriating those kinds of records and using them to tell our story. There's a kind of a layered effect that happens that way, and it mimics the way that history is layered on top of other histories and that stories are layered on top of other stories. Elizabeth Cook Lynn, who I think is a Lakota scholar and poet and author, says that a nation that does not tell its own stories cannot be said to be a nation at all. So she was very aware of the fact that if we don't tell our stories, somebody else is going to do it for us, and they're not going to do us any favors when they do it. So I think that, yes, we are appropriating and using some of the Western writing styles, but we're also modifying those very styles as we work with them, and we're changing them. There's a transformation that's happening. And that happens even when you're working in English, you know, not in your native tongue, because we're, as Harjo says, reinventing the enemy's language, right? We're using it for our own purposes. So there's a lot of different layers, I think, that you have to just kind of keep your eye out for as you're reading.
Any other questions? Okay, good.
Hello. I'm part of the student union here at UVA for Native American students, and so it's really great to be here, and I'm learning a lot. I had a question for Deborah mostly, and also for Karen. One of your poems spoke about apologies and various apologies that have been attempted to be made by the United States. I also know in the news, kind of in the last couple of years, that Pope Francis issued an apology for the effects of missionary work on Indigenous peoples. So I kind of wanted to ask you guys how you feel about that, or whether or not that comes out in your interests, and how you feel about reconciliation.
You want to start?
It's a really loaded question. I will say what my mom used to say to me when I apologized. It's really not about
the apology. It's about what you do next. And that's kind of how I feel about Pope Francis's apology. It doesn't come with any change. If you don't change what you're doing, then you're really not apologizing. You're just moving your mouth and things are coming out of it, you know? So there has, you know, yes, an apology was made. No, it didn't change anything in the lives of California Indian people or other Native people around the world. So that's part of what I'm interested in, is what's beyond the apology. The Truth and Reconciliation Project in Canada was extremely powerful, but it also created a situation where Native people were actually paying the price by having to get up in front of people and testify about the sexual abuse they suffered. And several of those people later went on and committed suicide. They were so extremely damaged by that experience. So again, who was being punished for Native abuse? It was almost like Native people were being punished for being abused. So there's a lot of issues around apologies. And I think one of the things I would like to see instead of apologies are changes in laws, changes in land rights, treaty rights, the right to hunt and fish, the right to education, things like that. So it's a big question.
Yeah, I would add to that, I mean, kind of tack on the same idea, that if it changes the terms of relationship such that people really are equal partners at the table and mutual respect is happening, then yes, it's a worthwhile apology. I had one poem I wrote called Jamestown Revisited, where the Episcopal Church members were going to apologize to us for everything since 1607. And it was an event that was designed to make them feel good. But nobody was going to give us back the land when they died, you know. So in what way are we being honored by them saying sorry?
Who benefits from the apology?
Yeah. So I think it's good. If nations want to entertain this and have a real conversation and issue something that says we're not ever going to do this again and they mean it, cool. Most of the indigenous people I've talked to said it sounded good, but it hasn't really happened at this point.
It was quite emotional for those people. The apology in Australia was made to the Stolen Generation, where 1 in 3 Aboriginal children were taken from their families. And so you can see the damage that that would have done for future generations. But it was quite emotional for people. I think even though they knew maybe nothing was going to come out of it later, it was more about somebody's acknowledged mm-hmm. what happened to us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so in that way, there was, I know we were all part of that event, and it was quite, I was actually in Mexico giving a speech to some South American ambassadors, and we were crying mm-hmm. because it was just so emotional to see that somebody had finally acknowledged what had happened in our history. But you're right, it's what comes after that that counts. But in the moment, it was quite an emotional event.
Yeah, unfortunately in Australia, what came after the apology was the taking over of 76 Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory. So the troops were sent in, and within that 12-month period, there was an increase in mining leases of 300%. So unfortunately, yeah, the apology was used as a bit of a Trojan horse to take further control over Aboriginal land.
Actions speak louder than words.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes we think about it, I'm a historian, I think about it like, it's important, an acknowledgement is important, but have this, we talk about the redemption cake, and there's a lot of people want to come in now and have a slice of the redemption cake. tend to make them feel good, but what does it really do? And so we, yes, the acknowledgement, I agree with Kathy, but, yeah, it's the actions that speak louder than words. And there's a whole, you know, there was like an outpouring of different things that people wanted to say and give back, but it was, in a way, part of a settler absolution as well, too, or redemption cake. And we always say, well, eat it with lots of salt.
Bruce, sorry.
Yeah, and if people apologise and then keep believing the same history they believed the day before, nothing has changed. And I wrote a book called Dark Emu because I, after having written another history about the contact wars, I found a lot of journalists were disbelieving that a war had actually taken place for the land. And so when I started talking about the term hunter-gatherer as it had been applied to Aboriginal people, I had a meeting with some professors who were the head of the publishing company that was supposed to be publishing that book, and they started telling me that I couldn't use the word agriculture next to the word Aborigine. And I realised then that I was going to have to rely exclusively on the Gospels. And the Gospels for Australian historians are the explorers' journals and diaries. Mm-hmm. And so the proof of the history of Australia is actually in those journals. I didn't know it as comprehensively at that time as I did once I'd started reading the rest of them. And it was just amazing to me to see how much information had been recorded about the real spirituality, economy and culture of Australian Aboriginal people. And having used the sources that are seen in Australia as being the Gospels, it was very hard for people to refute it because it's irrefutable.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming. Please feel free to approach the various writers and to join us at the reception.
Thank you.
Thank you.